Blog Talk Radio.
Jean-Luc, Geordi Specs, mysteries on the holodecks, asteroids, triple droids, telepathic betazoids, transporter, deadly claw, visitor from L.A. Law, photons, no Kirk, captain has gone berserk, shuttlecraft, Council Troy, Dr. Crusher's little boy, Klingon rights, parasites, new heights, phaser fights, Data's head, Tasha's dead, Riker's hanging by a thread, celebration, transformations, everyone to battle
stations.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to a brand new podcast. We seem to be doing a lot of brand new ones lately. I think it's got something to do with this little thing called COVID-19. We're all trapped inside and looking for something to do and looking for some human contact. And what better way than to do a podcast? And what makes this podcast so unique is that you guys listening right now can call 646-668-2433 and join us. That's right. You can call us and talk to us. Tell us what you think, what's going on, or just call and say hello. You know, we love to interact with you guys. We love to hear from you guys. And you can do it right now. We'll be here for the next hour. The number is 646-668-2433. Give us a call, say hello, and we'll get you on the air. So as I was saying, this is a brand new podcast. This is the first one of many, I hope. And this is going to be called Book Nook. Now, we're doing this one in place of Comic Corner, because the comic books haven't been produced because of the COVID virus. And so we still wanted to give you guys something. And Charles and Eric have been reading, well, finished reading this book called Last Best Hope, which is a prelude to the Jean-Luc Picard series, Star Trek Picard, and have been itching to talk about it. We just couldn't figure out a way to squeeze it into the schedule. And now we do. So we're going to be talking about that tonight, and I'll be your silent host, Uncle Jim, because I didn't read the book. I might pop in with a question here or there or play a soundbite once in a while if I have one that fits. But for the most part, it's going to be Charles and Eric discussing the book and telling you what they thought about it. So without any further ado, we have with us Charles, and Charles is out in Las Vegas. How you doing tonight, Charles?
I'm doing good. Just snuck off of work just in time on a Zoom or a Google Hangouts conference to get over here and enjoy the book.
Yeah, I actually had to work today too. I had to go in for 4 hours, which was strange, but it's kind of good to have some type of normalcy again, even though it was only short, even though the building was empty, just to have somewhere to go and something to do really felt good. It made me feel normal.
Yeah,
I can imagine. You know? And
just
the weather up here in Vermont is beautiful. How's the weather out in Vegas?
Oh, we're in actually 70s right now. We're going to hit 70s and 80s this week. So we've got a bit of a warm spell coming through with occasional chances for rain like today, which I think is not going to happen. But we're getting some warm weather. Kind of hard to be stuck inside.
It was nice here today. It was 41. I took the dog out for a nice walk. It was beautiful. Leslie got snow up in Saranac Lake, believe it or not. But it's that time of year. And we also have with us Eric. Eric's out in Portland. How you doing tonight, Eric?
I am doing fantastic. I'm staring out the window at a beautiful day. It's about 68 degrees and sunny here, light breeze. One of those days where if you're out in the sun, you can get kind of nice and warm, but you never get too hot. I like that kind of weather.
Yeah, that's like a fall day.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where it's in the mid-70s, you know.
Oh, it was a bit humid this morning. For you guys, yeah, 30%, nothing. For us, 30%, quite a bit. I was actually done with my walk, sweating a bit.
Ooh. Yeah, I technically live in the Pacific Northwest here, of course, which is known as a rainforest. So it's, you know, we get some wetness here, that's for sure.
Oh, I'm down in the desert. We don't get the humidity.
Yeah.
I'm up in the sticks. I'm in the mountains, the Green Mountains of Vermont. So we get everything. But anyways, guys, we're gonna be talking about a brand new book, The Last Best Hope. It's the prelude to Jean-Luc Picard. Our phone number here is 646-668-2433. I have faith that you'll call.
Getting from here to here, it's been a long time, but your time is finally here. You can feel the change in your thoughts right now. Nothing's in your way, and they're not gonna hold you down no more. No, they're not gonna hold you down, 'cause we've got faith, that's your call. We wanna hear what you have to say. We've got faith to believe in church talking today. You've got faith in your fingers. All you gotta do is dial now. You can reach us right now. We've got faith. We've got faith. Faith that you call.
And just one more time, 646-668-2433 is that phone number. And before we get going, I just wanted to remind you guys that being a live podcast and keeping that phone line open for all of our great podcasts, Stunt Treks with E. Leslie Hoffman, our new one, Sounds of Sci-Fi with myself and Charles, this one, The Book Nook, The Comic Corner, The War Room with GM Chris, and of course, Trek Talking and Beyond every Thursday night. We have to keep the phone line open, and that costs money. And in these trying times that we're going through right now, we could really use your help. And all we really need is a dollar. A dollar and a dream is all we need. And you can go to patreon.com/trektalkin and pledge a dollar a month. And that will help keep this show and all of our other shows on the air and keep that phone line open, 646-668-2433, giving all of you guys around the globe the opportunity to call and be part of this show live two or three or four times a week, or however many different podcasts we have going on at any given time. And you can also check us out on Facebook at Trek Talking and Beyond. And of course, you can go to the Leslie Hoffman Appreciation Organization Facebook page as well and just say hello to Leslie. So with that out of the way and all my talking done, I'm going to be quiet now. But you may have noticed that the intro we played at the beginning of the show was our Trek Talking and Beyond intro. And that's because, well, this Book Nook is a brand new show. We don't have an intro for it yet. But if we keep doing it, we'll come up with one. And just to give you guys just a little reminder of how far Captain Picard has come and how far we've come, I have a clip that I thought might be fun to play for you guys because, as you know, Star Trek Picard takes place 18 years after the final TNG film, which is Nemesis, which is what? Much, much after the TNG episode Encounter at Farpoint. So I just wanted to play for you guys a little clip to get you in the mood. And this clip was from September 26, 1987. That was the premiere of the Star Trek The Next Generation movie of the week, Encounter at Farpoint. And this was the first introduction that we ever got to the character of Captain Jean-Luc Picard as portrayed by the awesome, awesome Patrick Stewart.
Captain's log, stardate 41153.7. Our destination is planet Deneb 4, beyond which lies the great unexplored mass of the galaxy. My orders are to examine Farpoint, a starbase built there by the inhabitants of that world. Meanwhile, I am becoming better acquainted with my new command, this galaxy-class USS Enterprise. I am still somewhat in awe of its size and complexity. As for my crew, we are short in several key positions, most notably a first officer, but I am informed that a highly experienced man, one Commander William Riker, will be waiting to join the ship at our Deneb 4 destination.
So you guys remember that very first time that you saw Picard?
No, for sure. Yeah, I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was 1989. I was still in high school, and I remember for months ahead of time being so excited that they were finally going to have some new Star Trek after, what was it, 25, 30 years, something like that. And I just was ecstatic, and it came on. I remember I sat down with my entire family and made my entire family sit down to watch, and I did not come from a family of science fiction folks. But we all sat down and watched Encounter at Farpoint together. And I remember when it was over, I turned around and I looked at my family and I was like, that was amazing. What did you guys think? And they were all kind of like, meh.
there's two things I remember about it other than Worf, a Klingon, which blew me away. But when the Enterprise, that scene that we just listened to, actually shows the Enterprise, the way the Enterprise flies into the shot and the camera goes right over the hull and right into the captain's window where we see the silhouette of Captain Picard and he steps out into the light with something we had never seen on Star Trek before or even on TV up to that point. And the minute I saw that, I was captivated by the show. I was like, wow, this is going to be something special. And the other thing, which might sound minuscule, but I saw it, I caught it, I remembered it, and it sticks in my brain to this day, is the opening credits when the Enterprise is flying by. When the Enterprise flies by the first time, you see a crewman walk by the window of the aft ready room. And I was like, wow, they put that much care into the show. This is going to be awesome. And I've been hooked ever since. How about you, Charles?
Oh, I think it was, I'm almost betting it was probably Mom and I in her room watching on the TV. And I remember as many times as she and I could, we'd watch new episodes of Star Trek because she and I were both Trekkies. And it was just, wow, a new series finally that we came up with. It's not every few years on the movie screen. It's not the repeats on TV. It's brand new episodes.
Yeah, what did they say? What was it? This isn't your father's Star Trek. Was that the tagline for it?
I don't remember it being that, but definitely it's true.
But so now that we've talked a little bit, now that we've wet your whistle a little bit and got your memories jogged to thinking back to the first time you saw Encounter at Farpoint, the first time you encountered the character of Jean-Luc Picard, and the first time you saw just how good Patrick Stewart really is, and the whole ensemble cast, I might add, as well. There's a brand new series on CBS All Access called Star Trek Picard. As I said earlier, it takes place, say, 20 years after the final movie, roughly, and we get to see an older, more grizzled Captain Picard. We get to see a man who, I don't know, maybe he has some regrets for some of the decisions he's made, and he's not the man that we saw on the show. He's defeated. He's a little bit beaten down. He's a little bit downtrodden, and he even says he's on his vineyard waiting to die, which is not the Picard that we're used to seeing. So that's where he starts off in the beginning of the show. The book actually takes place prior to that. Correct, guys?
Correct.
Correct.
So we're going to talk about that a little bit. And since we're talking about Star Trek Picard, and since the book is about Star Trek Picard, I've got one more to get you guys right to suck you right in. This is the theme song from Star Trek Picard, the TV show, which is currently on CBS All Access. And we're going to play this to get you right into the mood. And then Eric and Charles are going to dive right in. They're not going to hold any punches. They're not going to pull anything back. They are going to lay it on you and lay it on you straight about the new book, Star Trek Picard, The Last Best Hope. Maybe. Here we go.
Thank you.
boy Jeff Russo is brilliant, and that should put you in the mood to talk about Star Trek. Because I should have played that as our entry theme song. What's wrong with me? I'm old and senile, I guess.
Well, sometimes you got to get it figured out, you know.
Yeah, so it's our first show. We're getting there. So without any further ado, guys, I am going to turn the microphone over to Charles and Eric, and they can dive right in and talk about the book. And I don't have anything to say. If I have a question, I'll bop in and ask you guys. But from this point on, it's up to you guys. So take it away, guys.
Awesome. Thanks, Jim. So I guess we should start our conversation, Charles, by saying that we are going to weed deep into spoiler territory here. So if you don't want spoilers about the book, you may choose to turn this podcast off right now, come back and check it out afterwards, after you've had a chance to read it, see if you agree with us or not. But from here on, all reveals are on the table. So we're going to kind of go through the book and talk about each chapter, but just to kind of give you the overall layout of the land here. So the clip that Jim played from Encounter at Farpoint, that happens in 2364. And Nemesis happens in 2379. So you basically have, you know, 15 or so years that happen in Next Generation from the beginning to Nemesis. Then this book starts out in 2381. So it starts 2 years after the end of Nemesis, and it goes all the way up until 2385, until the events that we actually see at some of the events that we see in kind of flashbacks at the beginning of Picard. So that's the lay of the land. Charles is going to start us out by kind of summarizing the chapters and going through each one, and then we'll chat about each one. So take it away, Charles.
All right. Chapter one, we start off with part one of The New Hope. And these five chapters go through 2381 to 2382.
Hello.
We kind of get started with Picard on the, I think it's a little bit of the vineyard. Then we start getting to learn about characters. The first one we get to learn about, go ahead.
No, you're right. Yep.
The first one we really get to learn about is Raffi. Raffi's lieutenant commander and being part of the research. She's part of the group that discovers that Romulan star is going to go supernova.
Eric,
so
can
in
you hear
this,
me?
Yeah, I sure can.
We can hear you.
I can't. Can you hear? Can anyone hear Charles?
Yeah, I can hear Charles. No, he's talking.
Oh, I must be a problem with my connection because
I
don't
think
hear
we're
Charles.
Okay.
And also in this chapter, Picard, who's on the Enterprise, sees the report that Raffi and her crew has put together, and Captain Clancy, I believe it, and the group chooses that Picard needs to lead this group. So Picard is then promoted to admiral. Worf is promoted to captain of the Enterprise, and LaForge asks that I need to go to Mars and help with the shipbuilding. And that's a short summary of what happens in this chapter. What do you say, Eric?
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. We get to touch back in with a few of our Next Generation friends here. Worf is never actually on screen, but he is referenced. There's like a pretty good discussion in the book about why he's made captain. And they draw some comparisons between the way the Klingons used to have a relationship with the Federation. And then, of course, the Khitomir Accords happened, and it was kind of a, you know, look how far we've come moment. And here we are at the beginning of maybe the same type of process with the Romulans. So I thought that was pretty cool. And
now I have a question for you guys. Being the ultimate Worf fan that I am, my favorite character, why does he leave Martok and the Klingon Empire, which is where we saw him last, and resign from ambassadorship and come back? Do they ever explain what happened with Martok? No?
No, because in Nemesis, he was on the Enterprise. and we're basing our time after the Enterprise.
And I think but
after Nemesis.
And I think if you want Jim, if you want a canon, like in canon description of what happens to him, the answer is that one doesn't exist. But there are books that talk about what happens to Worf afterwards. And there are a couple of different books that give a couple of different accounts of what happens to him. Some stuff is actually mentioned in the Kalis book that we reviewed by Michael J. N. Friedman a couple weeks ago, or that we chatted about. So we don't really know, like from an in-canon standpoint, but there are a couple different explanations out there. Some of them having to do with the fact that he wasn't really his role was to kind of get it set up and get things rolling, and then for him to actually go back to Starfleet.
Well, I know that I know the real reason. The real reason is Michael Dorn had a contract and he was going to be in the movies. That's the real reason. So Worf was going to be in the movies, period. But it doesn't. I mean, he was on Deep Space Nine and he always ended up on the Enterprise, even though he was on Deep Space Nine. And then he leaves Deep Space Nine and takes off with Martok for his dream of reorganizing the Klingon Empire. And then now he's not there anymore. So I as far as I'm concerned, you know, my character of Worf has an opening there. And people keep talking about wanting to see him on Picard. And unless they want to fill that gap, I don't want them to throw Worf in there just to throw him in there.
Well, I will say that remember that this happens, after Nemesis. And so Worf is on the Enterprise at the end of Nemesis and he continues to serve. And presumably it's then from there that he gets promoted in this book back to captain or up to captain. Huh? So.
That's cool.
All right.
I'm done. Continue.
All right, Charles, what's next?
Okay, chapter 2. There's a lot in this one. Raffi gets to meet Picard. Picard gets assigned the Verity. Through the situation, a lot of discussion with Raffi and Picard. Raffi gets promoted to XO, which means she now becomes his new number one. LaForge finds out he's getting a lot of resistance from Mars because a lot of people don't want to give up the projects they're working on. And it takes a lot of work trying to get it. They also realize they don't have the manpower they need to sit there and build all the pieces they need to build ships. We learn that Raffi has a husband and a son. And we also find out that LaForge contacts Bruce Maddox because one of his crew members has some opinions about android and robotics. And that's chapter 2.
Yeah, so I think some of my favorite parts about this chapter are the parts about Raffi. She's personally my favorite character from Star Trek Picard. And I think in this chapter, you get a really nice setup to her situation. You know, basically, she's got the family that she's already away from because of her assignment in kind of the Romulan Affairs division of Starfleet. And when she gets this offer from Picard, she realizes that one thing that maybe Charles and I haven't given enough weight to is at the very beginning of this book, when we find out that the supernova is going to happen and Starfleet, basically Picard goes in and helps convince Starfleet that they need to help the Romulans. This is a massive, massive undertaking. We're talking, 10,000 ships,
billions of people.
You know, they said 900 million as kind of the number that they said in the show of Picard. This makes it clear that that is a population of Romulus in some areas that are very close to Romulus, and that the supernova is going to take out way more than that number of people. So they need to build something like 10,000 ships as quickly as they can to get people out of here. That is a huge commitment for everybody. And so everybody on Mars, as Charles said, is upset. They have to give up their pet projects to switch every single resource. This takes every single resource the Federation has. They start pulling projects all over the galaxy and put it all into this effort. which is a big undertaking, you know? And
yeah,
you can imagine it would make a lot of people upset, right?
And there are repercussions that we will talk about later.
Absolutely. I also really like the fact that it's kind of Geordi and this woman, Mackenzie, who initially come up with this idea that they may need to talk to Bruce Maddox about adding some synthetic labor to the pool. And it has to do, in the book, they sort of describe it as it's labor that machines can't do because it takes a certain amount of decision making and dexterity and da-da-da-da-da. And there's some reason that they need to make some type of anthropomorphic android to be able to do this work.
Yep.
All right. What's next?
Okay, chapter 3. As we learn, Maddox kind of looks at Geordi and thinking, okay, why do I want to do this? I've been working on the positronic brain, and yet you want me to work on toys. And he finally realizes he has no real choice. He has to do this. Now we find out the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge. We have a scientist who looks at the data. They've taken the Romulan data and the Romulan figures. This person then looks at the numbers herself and says the Romulan data is inaccurate. The Romulan data isn't going far enough. It's going to be X number of miles away from this supernova. And the data says, no, we got 1.5, 2 times the amount of space is going to be destroyed from it. And Maddox gets to meet a temporary student, that's an exchange student, that was Dr. Agnes Geordi. That's our chapter 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this discovery that the Romulan supernova is so much worse than the Romulans had been reporting is a theme that kind of repeats itself throughout the book. And we realize that really the Romulan government has been trying to save face all along, trying not to, ask for too much help, trying not to let their people know too much about what's going on. There are some great stories in here that talk about there's this group of 100 Romulan families that are like the super rich Romulan families, and they actually control a lot of the political power in the Romulan Empire. And it's interesting to kind of explore their culture as a culture based on greed, secrecy, property, ownership of property, meaning more than anything else. So I kind of dug that part about it, and there's a great line that has nothing to do with that in this in this chapter, but Rafi says it, and she reminds JL, she's like, when he kind of starts to get overwhelmed about all this stuff that has to happen very, very quickly, she says, how do you eat an elephant? And do you remember what he says, Charles?
Yes. One bite at a time.
That's right. One bite at a time. And on the show, it kind of mirrors when they say one impossible thing at a time. So nice part of this chapter.
But it's definitely interesting that Agnes is an exchange, and she's only there for a semester, where she's going to study a little bit of robotics, but that she's actually a medical doctor in her time. And that's going to get interesting as we get further in the book.
That's right. Yeah, we'll talk about that more in a little bit here.
Yeah. Then we get to chapter 4. Picard finally is, they're finally working on rescuing some of the planets in the outer rim. We're going inside the neutral zone, but we're dealing with some of the planets, the small planets, some of the foreign planets, a lot less important planets. So he had to deal with his first rescue group. And we learn a lot of the political issues that go on in there. And then we also get Raffi's first argument with her husband because she's not spending any time at home. And I think that's most of chapter four.
Yeah, and I think this might be the point that we learn that Raffi, or maybe it's later in the book, but we do learn at some point that Raffi is a person who has struggled with substance abuse for a very long time, since even before she was in Starfleet, and that it's been a demon that she's kind of carried around with her. Now, that doesn't pop up in this chapter, but we kind of see the seeds being sown for what's eventually going to happen with her putting her entire self also into this effort that the Federation has undertaken, and in her case, at the expense of her relationship with her family.
Yes.
This also, this chapter sort of introduces the idea of these fancy Romulans. They bring this Romulan onto the ship to be moved somewhere else, and he immediately is upset with the quality of his quarters, the size. He's not being treated the way he's supposed to be treated. This is an outrage, you know, that type
yeah.
of thing. So a little bit of Romulan fit throwing happening in this chapter as well.
We get a little bit of the understanding of the political structure of Romulans.
Which, as far as I knew, was kind of like, at least it's the first thing that I've read that kind of went into that much detail. I mean, you always kind of know that there's some sort of council and that sort of thing, but the influence that these families have on the politics of Romulus and the entire empire, I thought that was a really interesting part of this book.
Yep.
Huh.
Okay. On to chapter five, we learned the conditions for the first rescue group to where they're going to another Romulan planet. The conditions are very poor. They're thinking they're going into a city or a controlled area, and they get kind of put as refuge. So there's a rather there's a lot of problems with people wanting to actually go to this planet. We learn that Jurari was supposed to return back to Starfleet. She decided to change to stay on and work in robotics and continue working with Modix. We get a second group that's rescued. And because the problems of that one planet, Picard finds a planet just outside of the neutral zone that's welcoming, wanting the Romulans to come with them, come stay with them. And that started a little bit of our controversy and some of our problems coming up. And that's going to lead us into our second part. And then we've got the creation of the Daystrom A500, the first introductory model of a synth. And that ends part one.
The end of part one was pretty cool because you get Picard doing a standard Picard maneuver. What he does is he essentially says that the conditions on this planet are not good enough, and that it's inhumane to leave these people here. And so we're going to take them somewhere else, and it's outside the neutral zone. And the thing is that he doesn't consult Starfleet about it. He just does it.
Yep.
Because he thinks it's the right thing to do. And I kind of see this moment. I don't know about you, Charles, but I actually kind of, like, up until this moment, Picard's been feeling pretty confident that he can get this thing done, right? He's got it real well organized. It's an almost impossible task, but everything seems to be going the right direction. And I kind of feel like this moment is the moment when he makes this decision, and it's the first one that really backfires on him. And it's the moment when things kind of start to go south a little bit politically for this entire situation, particularly inside the Federation.
Well, we get sort of the beginning, and everything's somewhat running smoothly.
Yeah.
And that's going to be our beginning.
And I think
now we're going to get to the middle.
That's right. And, you know, the last thing I'll just say about your summary that you just gave is that it's pretty clear that Bruce Maddox first of all, did not want to be involved in constructing the synths at all. He sort of considers it way below his skills. He, as Charles said earlier, he considers these things toys and does not consider them, you know, to be even in the same ballpark. They're closer to a screwdriver on the line of evolution than to data, basically. And in this chapter, he actually calls them repulsive. And you get the sense that he's disgusted by the fact that he has kind of been forced into this just by the sheer fact that the Federation has chosen to help the Romulans. And so all along during this book, you're getting the same things that you get in some of Picard, but you get them in a little bit more detail with regards to, was it the right thing for the Federation to go and help the Romulans?
Oh, definitely. Okay. Now we're reaching part two, the best. 2383 to 2384. Chapter 6, we get the first repercussions from Picard putting a group of Romulans outside of the neutral zone, including having to go to the CNC, which is Captain Clancy, which we're going to see. We've seen a little bit of, we're seeing a lot more of. They finally settle things out that maybe they can patch things up. But in the process of sort of penalizing Picard, we get to Jeff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We get a Romulan agent assigned the Verity. And we're definitely question about who he is, what he represents, and we learn more about that in Chapter 7.
Yeah, I think everybody gets a pretty strong feeling when Tajuth comes on the scene that he may belong to a certain Romulan secret agency that we all know and love. And that is confirmed later. And we'll talk more about kind of how his character changes throughout the book. But I like the introduction of his character, you know, the idea that Starfleet is trying to patch things up with the Romulans by letting a Romulan be on their team. And, you know, you can never trust having a Romulan on your team. almost never, I'll say.
Yeah. Okay, Chapter 7. For me, this is the one time I will mention her because she's not one of my favorite characters. But we get to meet Junior Counselor Olivia Quest. She's a... not counselor. I can't think of the word for it. But she's sort of representative from one of the more outer planets.
Yeah, like a senator kind of to this... this small planet, yeah.
And then we get, in this chapter, we get teased on, we get a little bit of tease into the Picard series. And we go to Enixis, I believe.
I think that's how you say it, yeah. Enixis.
And who do we get to meet on there?
Well, we get to
meet Quat Malat,
mm-hmm.
which Jim may be familiar with. Those are the warrior nuns. This is when we first get to meet them. And we meet a 4 or 5 year old boy named Eleanor.
Wait a minute. That's a real thing? Romulan warrior nuns?
Better believe it. And I'll tell you, who they don't like. They do not like the Tal Shiar, but we'll talk about that next chapter.
No, that's this chapter.
Oh, is that this chapter too?
That's okay. This chapter when they go down there, and the Joss doesn't get a very good reception from the women.
No.
And it's admitted the fact that they know for a fact he is Tal Shiar. And Tal Shiar are the enemy of the Kuat Malak. They are opposed enemies. They have completely different philosophies. But we also learn a little bit about their society, including the fact that it's supposed to be women only. But as this young boy was abandoned, they could not find a home for him, so they chose to fix their rules to allow him to stay.
So, Charles, so their philosophy is total honesty all the time. So
yes.
The Romulan philosophy is total lies all the time?
Yes.
I can't think of the first. Something candor. What's the word?
Absolute candor. Yeah.
Absolute candor. Where they always say the complete truth. Even Eleanor kind of walks up to him and says, like, are these humans? They're ugly.
And you're right, Jim.
He's not hiding what he's feeling. He says exactly what he feels.
And you're right. They are set up as an exact counterpoint to the Romulans, who both in the Picard series and in this book are really shown to kind of be always lying, always obscuring. Even their houses that they live in don't have a real front door. In order to get into a Romulan home, you have to find the back or the side entrance and enter the home that way. In this chapter, they describe how when they first meet the Kuat Malat, and I didn't even pick up on this in the show until I read the book, and then I said, gosh, that makes a lot of sense. Look at their architecture. Their architecture is made so that it has these big open windows. They open their curtains all the time. They eat in groups. They commune with each other. Completely the opposite of what your standard Romulan would do. I thought that was a really cool thing that they developed more in this book.
Definitely.
And you know, Charles talked about Olivia Quest. I think she's a really important character that's introduced in this chapter because she's basically from this small world. And so you can imagine, what if the Federation pulls all of its resources from everywhere and kind of contracts in on itself so that it can make all of these starships and actually go help the Romulans? Well, the first worlds that are going to be affected by that are the tiny worlds that are out there. And so she actually begins speaking out against the mission and all the resources that are being used on it. And she becomes kind of the person who in the book represents that feeling within the Federation. Not everybody is on board with this thing, particularly people who are out on those small little worlds. And in fact, many of them threaten secession at one point or another.
Yeah, that's coming up.
All right. Next chapter, Charles.
Okay. Chapter 8, which I know is a lot of quest in there, but the main heart of this one I see is also the real formation of Girardi and Maddox's relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That they're turning more into a sort of a couple, but kind of hidden because they don't want people knowing about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you kind of get the sense that, so, you know, Maddox is obviously a very eccentric guy, and he kind of knows how brilliant he is. And the one thing about Girardi that really, really appeals to him is that she finds him absolutely fascinating. She thinks his brain is the sexiest thing in the world, and he picks up on that. And I think that that is kind of what forms the core of their relationship, and in fact, there are times when they have these great conversations when she influences him in one way or another. She convinces him to make this decision versus that decision. And you see how all of those little moments in time actually add up to things like the attack on Mars and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I agree with you, Charles. That's my favorite part of this this chapter.
Okay. Now we get into We kind of skimmed over the symposium, but I think I'm going to skip that.
Yeah.
So chapter 9, it's part of the story.
Yeah, yeah. They just try to find a clever way to get a bunch of Romulans and a bunch of Federation people together without arousing so much suspicion.
Yeah. But the report that the scientists in Cambridge came up with, Chapter 9, we find out the Romulan homeworld, Romulans deny that the data is true. That the Romulans are basically saying, okay, we're going on our, we're basing this on our data. Our data is false. Your data must have mistakes in it. And Picard gets to see his first challenge with the Tal Shiar, because they suddenly have a conflict on the planet that they're getting they're rescuing the people from. And the Tal Shiar came in and basically said, nope, go away. We're going to take care of this group. And we do know that there are probably some people on this planet the Tal Shiar didn't like. And one of Picard's crew members resigns due to the fact because they know blood was shed from Tal Shiar coming in and taking over the mission at this planet. So we kind of get an idea how bad things can get with Romulans in there.
Now, is this the mission that we read about in the comic book? The three-part countdown? Or no, different one?
Nope.
Different one. Yep.
The comic book actually doesn't tie into the book. They're completely separate.
But I will tell you that this particular chapter has another very cool tie-in. And, of course, when I figured out what it was, Jim, you were the first person I thought of. Does the planet Nimbus 3 ring a bell at all?
Oh, hell yes. The planet of intergalactic peace?
So this is the planet that we are talking about.
Nimbus 3? So, really?
Yeah. So this is the planet where people are refusing to leave.
Well, I mean, after Cybok unleashed all their inner fantasies and stuff, maybe they were just happy there, I guess.
But we get the Verity orbiting over this planet trying to resolve the situation. And at one point during the chapter, we have 8 Romulan ships that come and tell the Verity how it's going to go down, so to speak. Right, Charles?
Yep.
So yeah, this chapter, just kind of more story development, but no other big like character development moments, I don't think, in this one.
And then chapter 10, I think I just kind of got it up to saying this kind of sums up, we're kind of summing up to what's going to happen in part 3. They were just kind of tying up loose ends in here.
Yeah, the one thing that I'll say was, I think, pretty important about this chapter is that this is the chapter when we get a conversation between Aggie, which is what he calls her, and Bruce. And it's the moment when she kind of provides the spark of brilliance when he starts to think about this process of fractal neuronic cloning. And in fact, he references the fact, he's like, hey, I got B4 in the drawer over here, and I got a few dozen neurons. I kind of feel like maybe I could do something with this. And they get very excited about that. And that, of course, leads to a whole bunch of things that we end up seeing in the Picard series. That moment happens in this book when they first decide to go that way.
Okay. Now we're on to the last, part 3, 2385.
So 4 years after the book started.
And I will admit my notes are a little fuzzy because I ran out of time on studying. But I got some of the stuff down. So one of the events that happens in Chapter 11, we were talking about those small planets Well, those small planets are now starting to come in. Outer rim planets that talk about succession from the Federation of Planets, which means that they're starting to get black about saving the Romulans, which becomes a problem. And then we get the big news. Romulus finally admits, you're right. Your numbers are correct. Our numbers were wrong. And Romulus is in the path of destruction. Romulus suddenly asks for help, because they haven't really been trying to get people off of their planet. So all of a sudden we're having to go in and try. They're suddenly saying, Federation, can you come in and rescue us? And this is the first time that we see weakness from the Romulans.
Yeah, I mean, the description at the beginning, I was just going to say, they talk about climate change and that sort of stuff on these planets, because you can imagine this thing starts to expand. And some of the descriptions that they give of the conditions on these inner planets are really, really terrible.
Yeah. We also get an interesting tie-in to TNG. A communication comes in for Picard, and they find out it is Spock. Says, can you help me get out of, can you help me get off of Romulus? And he doesn't need transport. He just needs a chance to be able to escape with a few of his people that are on Romulus. But he begs Picard to go in and help as many people as you can, that the people of importance will want to go first, but don't forget the others on the planet. And I thought, and you get to see Spock's ship actually leaving. And that's an interesting tie-in to TNG and one of the books that I read with crossover, that Spock was still on the planet. And that hits chapter 11.
Yeah, my favorite part of this chapter is definitely learning more about how the Romulans think, and they put things like saving face over the safety of their own population. They actually knew for several years that there were problems with the star and that it was going to go supernova, and they did absolutely nothing about it. And in fact, only a few people were allowed to even know that it was occurring. And you know, our scientist, our Romulan scientist, who sort of figured it out at the beginning too, well, we'll see where he ends up at the end of the book, but it's just there's a lot of exploration of what living a life of constant secrecy brings you in a society.
Okay. My notes are a little hazy on chapter 12 and 13.
Well, that's interesting. My notes are a little hazy there too, but I believe that what we're eventually leading toward here is I think there's another story of evacuation of a planet, and there is the discussion of the scientist Vertit, who's the Romulan guy that kind of figured things out.
Yeah.
I will say one of the things that we didn't mention, Charles, that I really like about this book in general, and I was just kind of reminded about it, was that each one of these chapters starts with a admiral's log. So you kind of have a real kind of TNG feel to it. Like at the very beginning of each chapter, you get your little, here's what Picard's thinking, and then you launch into whatever adventure you're going to have during that chapter.
In that chapter, yeah. I forgot about that. Yes, that's a good point too. He'd always kind of summarize like he would a center captain's log.
Yeah, and
okay.
And the, And the other things that they kind of talk about in these two chapters are there's a lot of talk from the Federation about how they need a political win, not a political win, I guess a PR win. There's been so much resistance, and in fact, resistance grows every single day. And they start kind of referring to Vashti and how well the relocation of the Kuat Malat went in that case. And they use that as their success story. And they say, we need another Vashti. If you want to keep people on board, we need another Vashti.
Well, on to then for chapter 14. As all this is kind of coming around, we get to see Geordi's on a shuttle. He is out and about, and they get a news story. The same news story that we saw on Children of Mars. Mars has been attacked. And the death toll is severe. And we're happy to learn Geordi lives. But a lot of people on Mars don't. And that kind of shakes us up, and that kind of throws us into turmoil into our final chapter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the moment I remember when I read this chapter and, you know, Geordi's on this shuttle and they talk about the destruction of Mars. I breathed a total sigh of relief because watching Picard, I wasn't sure whether he was still going to be around or not.
Exactly. We kind of worried about Geordi.
So I kind of feel like he might be a good candidate for somebody who might show up in season two as well as possibly
I think so.
Yeah.
Yep. And then we reach chapter 15. And Picard gets recalled to Earth. And he gets put in front of the CNC, Commander-in-Chief. And we get bits and pieces of this meeting in Picard, one of the flashbacks. This is where the flashbacks really come in. We see his talk with Raffi after the meeting. He goes in the meeting, and we've heard about what he said in the show. Here we actually get to see him talk about saying, we've got to still recover these Romulans. We've got to help the Romulans. No, we're giving up on the Romulans. We've lost Mars because of this. There's so much repercussion right now, so many people against. They're willing to abandon the Romulans. And Picard puts his ultimatum saying, you either do this or I'm going to resign. And they take his resignation. And he goes out to talk to Raffi into what's happened and how she feels about it. And her last scene with him is she's called the CNC. And I think from there, our book kind of ends.
Yeah. One of my favorite scenes from this particular chapter is the one where Raffi and Picard are actually sitting on that park bench that we see them in the series, in the flashback. But they're actually prepping for the meeting. And they're talking about, Raffi will say, okay, they're going to ask about this. What will you say then? And Picard kind of comes back. And, we didn't talk about it at the beginning, but one of the reasons that Picard chose Raffi to be his right-hand person on this project, it wasn't just that she was part of the Romulan, the Department of Romulan Affairs. It just wasn't the fact that she was the foremost expert on Romulans in the Federation. But actually, there's a great scene early in the book where Picard calls Beverly Crusher for advice. And he's like, Beverly, I've got this big thing that I've been asked to do. I'm kind of freaking out about it. I just need some advice. And Beverly Crusher says to him, get somebody as your right-hand person who isn't afraid of you. And Picard's like, what do you mean not afraid of me? And she kind of, give them the what for about how intimidating he is as a person and about how many people find him unapproachable. And I think that you could kind of imagine that. I mean, the most decorated captain in Starfleet at that point, you know, survivor of the Borg, I mean, this guy's got so many credentials. Of course, he's going to be intimidating. And right from the get-go, Raffi is not intimidated by him. She's just like telling things the way they are. And he really appreciates that. And I think that her character in this book a little bit ties into the Kawat Milat and the Elnor story with their idea of absolute candor as well. And you start to see that there's even more of a two-pronged story being explored here, where you've got the people who are kind of always telling the truth and thinking about things, and you've got the people who are always in secrecy and trying to hide things. So very interesting. You also get the scene at the end of this chapter where Maddox actually leaves Jurati and kind of goes into hiding with his neurons.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'd like to interject something. The attack on Mars in Star Trek history is the largest amount of casualties that has ever been stated on any film or in any movie. 93,000 plus people were killed on Mars, and that's the highest number we've ever heard. Best of Both Worlds wasn't that high. We've never had a number of casualties on any attack that's been as high as Mars. That's how big of a deal the Mars attack is in Picard. It's the largest ever, which is something that I think people need to bear in mind. And secondly, yes, LeVar Burton's going to be on Picard Season 2. We're going to talk about this Thursday night on Trek Talking and Beyond. But yes, he's going to be on Picard Season 2. So there you have it.
Oh, cool.
So there you go.
There you go.
So yeah, turns out he is going to be on there. So
this
Charles.
Is definitely, I was going to say, Card. And you're one of those kind of people that you just kind of want to watch Picard and you're happy with there. That's good. But if you really want to get an idea of a backstory, this definitely is one of the very well written, very well put together backstories for a Star Trek series.
Yeah.
I
was just going to say, Charles, I would absolutely agree with you because it ties in so closely with what we've seen. And, you know, you'll get folks who will say, well, it's still just a novel. Yes. And yet,
but
every single thing here leads directly into what we see in Picard.
But the thing is, we do know for a fact that the author had direct connection into the writer's room.
Mm-hmm.
She had details of what was going on. So you know that there are bits and pieces that she tied in that fit right into the series itself.
Mm-hmm.
So this is definitely, as J.K. always puts it, I call this definitely canon adjacent.
Well, and don't
may not be pure canon. But this is probably as close to canon as you're going to get without being on the screen.
Not only that, but this writer in particular, I mean, Una McCormick, if you haven't read her before, she's really well known for, you know, Star Trek Deep Space Nine novels. She's got a Star Trek Discovery novel. She's written Doctor Who novels. She wrote this really awesome Garrick story that was called Enigma Tales for Deep Space Nine. So she's a pretty accomplished science fiction writer that has written some good stuff, not only in the Star Trek universe, but, you know, in Doctor Who universe and that kind of stuff, too.
So she's well-versed not only in sci-fi in general, but she's also successful and well-known enough that Star Trek is willing to have her work on a novel in the middle just before we actually get the TV series, or just actually as the TV series comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you get to see what's going on with Picard. Okay, if you want to be the one reading the backstory, here you go.
Mm-hmm. So, Charles, let's do the standard thing that we always do at the end when we talk about an episode. On a scale of 1 to 10, what would you overall give The Last Best Hope by Una McCormick?
Oh, jeez. I'm not sure I'd quite go to a straight 10, but I almost would may go with a 9.8 or so, as this book is almost perfect. How about you?
Yeah, I'm definitely up in that 9 range. I'm a sucker for headcanon, and I love to know all of the motivations and finer points that lead up to decisions that are made. So I really liked filling in all the little gaps and stuff here. I also found the book really easy to read. I like the lengths of the chapters and just kind of the way the language flowed and everything. So as a book, I really enjoyed reading it. And then being adjacent to, of course, one of my favorite shows, I really liked it. So I'm going to give this one definitely a 9.2. Just a really, really solid book that I feel like every Star Trek fan should read, or at least, you know, if you're into books, give it a go. Highly recommend this one.
Yes. Now, we've got quite a few little things that we've missed out, quite a few things we missed out in the high points, as the movie would do. Okay, we hit the high points in the movie. We left quite a few different things out in the conversation. But there is just so much detail in this book. Even just to go back and try to summarize it quickly, there were so many high points and so many details that occurred in it. All the work scientists did trying to work on the information about the supernova,
mm-hmm.
and the scientist that was on Romulus who was left in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you guys a question. We hear Admiral Clancy, when she tells off the card the first time, that several planets were going to leave the Federation, and there was a lot, I think she said, 14 or something, I don't remember the exact number,
mm-hmm.
but there was a lot of planets that were going to leave, and you guys bring this up again in the book. So my question is, does it seem like the Federation prior to the Romulan, obviously there's got to be something going on prior to the Romulan situation that would make these planets want to leave. And where are these planets going to go? Is there a problem brewing in the Federation that might lead to the state of the Federation that we see in Star Trek Discovery, where the Federation flag is down to only 6 planets? Is there anything in this book that alludes to what fractured the Federation?
We don't get that, but okay, why did some of the planets want to succeed from Starfleet? Well, the thing is, these planets normally would have replicator ships coming in to doing construction projects. And these ships are being taken away from those planets to go help build areas of planets for the Romulans to live in. So they were feeling that the Romulans were being considered more important than they were.
And it's what they saw as broken promises, right? I mean, a lot of these planets are brought into the Federation because the Federation promises them that they will give them technology, they will, you know, make them part of their economy, this and that. I mean, that's what entices planets to join the Federation. And if the entire structure of the way that resources flow throughout the Federation suddenly changes and all of those promises are broken, where are those planets left? And, you know, how are they going to react to that? I think it's interesting that it's the Federation's failed promises that makes these folks want to leave, which makes total sense to me. Also in this book, you've got, you know, the Kawat Malat and that entire society, which literally doesn't make promises, because that is like, you don't make a promise because you're never sure you can fulfill it, you know?
Yeah. What does she say in Picard? She says promises are like a prison or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't make yourself someone else's jailer.
Right.
So yeah. So yeah, nice little tie in there. And you know, I like books and stories where there's not a clear bad guy and good guy. I always like the stories where the bad guy thinks he's doing the right thing the entire time, you know? And I kind of feel like the Federation feels like they're doing the right thing all along the way here. You know, we don't get the story of O and kind of the stuff that's going on in the background, but all the people who are in charge that are legitimate really think they're making the right decisions along the way. And the reason that Clancy gets so frustrated with Picard is that Picard is single-minded. We are going to help these people no matter what. And Clancy is actually the one that has to deal with Picard on one side, who's leading the mission. And then she also has to deal with the public, right? And all the repercussions that actually come from that decision. So it's kind of like you realize that it's Picard's absolute confidence that he can get her done that actually leads to his downfall in the end, because he can't get her done. He has to break the promises in the end, and it's all of those broken promises that start to cause the Federation to crumble. That's what I think, and I think that that's probably what's going to lead. I mean, there may be other things in the Discovery series that come from some of the other stories that we got from Picard, like the Romulan infiltrating Federation, that kind of stuff. But I think it's fundamentally this taking every single resource and putting it into one project that caused the problem.
So, in the short trek episode Calypso. We meet Kraft, and Kraft says that they're at war with the Fedresh, and they're from Alcor 6.
Alcor 4.
You think that that's one of the planets that breaks away and way, way, way back? Because he's clearly human.
Yeah, it could be. You know, do they break away? Or I still wonder if the Federation and... you know, if the Vedresh, first of all, is the same thing as the Federation. We've all kind of been assuming that it is. And if it is, you know, why would they be fighting a war against them? Even if it was a, you know, we don't want to join your club type thing, the Federation would have to be in a very different place to want to fight a war over that.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Or the Federation does something that offends people.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, let's go back to the Maquis episodes of Deep Space Nine. Federation did the same thing. They abandoned all those planets and caused a lot of strife, and a lot of planets left the Federation over that. When they seceded, all those planets became Cardassian planets. That pissed off a lot of people too.
You know, and it's actually that moment is actually referenced as well in this book. They talk about how one of the characters in here is remembering the things that happened on Bajor and kind of drawing connections between those two stories.
So, you know, I think I'm going to say something that may or may not, but when you look at Worf has, in Worf's mind, the perfect opinion of what a Klingon should be and should do. And Worf is all full of honor and honesty and pride. And when Worf meets the rest of the Klingons, he finds out that Klingons like Duras are backstabbing. They lie, they cheat, they steal, they do whatever they need to do to get their goals accomplished. And now here we have Picard, who's looking at the Federation full of ideals and ethics and finding out that maybe the Federation isn't what he thought it should be.
It's true. I think the one really cool thing about this book is that, and I hope that this follows through in season 2, is that it really is clear that the Federation is not a bad guy because of this, you know, that like, I think it's easy for us to take a decision that didn't go the way that everybody planned and say that the person that made that decision is evil, or that the group, I mean, clearly there are some decisions like the occupation of Bajor that are evil, but that being said, it is also possible that people, you know, what does Picard say? He says, it's possible to make no mistakes along the way and still lose. And that's almost what's happening with the Federation here. They feel like they're making all the right moves along the way, and yet it's just not coming out the way that they planned.
And it's hard. It's hard to say, because we don't know how deep O and her operatives are buried into Starfleet and just what they're doing to sabotage this whole thing. We don't really know. I mean,
also
being a Commodore in charge of Starfleet security is a pretty powerful place for a spy to be.
Yeah.
So we don't know just how deep their mold actually went. Picard may have been doomed from the start. I mean, we just don't know. But the question comes down to an episode we're going to talk about on Trek Talk and tomorrow, Thursday, where Admiral Nechayev confronts Picard on why you didn't kill the Borg when you could have. You could have wiped them out. And Picard's like, the Federation doesn't have the right to decide the fate of an entire race. And he doesn't. He saved the Borg and Hugh. So I guess the question comes down to, was it right for the Federation to offer aid to the Romulans? Was that the right thing to do, or was it the wrong thing to do? I guess is what it comes down to. What do you think, Charles? Should they have let? Well, better yet, you know what? Something that bugs me about Star Trek is the Klingon. I love my Klingon. I just feel that the destruction of practice and the destruction of the Klingon homeworld was just brushed aside and never ever got back to ever again. So obviously, the Federation helped the Klingon, because in Star Trek VI, they were talking about offering Klingons a safe haven in the Federation and blah, blah, blah. So would you guys agree that the Federation did offer assistance to the Klingons, although we didn't really see it? Would you agree to that?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. They did offer assistance. But they didn't pull all the resources, though, the way that they did.
No, but they did help the Klingons, because the Klingons were going to die. Their planet was going to, we don't really know, it wasn't a supernova, but the Klingon Empire was at a precipice and they were in danger. They could have attacked the Federation, which they said, but they didn't. They became our friends. So I'm with you guys. I'm going to assume that the Federation offered as much assistance as possible to help their enemies, the Klingons, and become friends. I'm gonna make that assumption. You guys agree with that?
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's go with that, and let's look at the Romulans now. So now we have a similar situation, albeit a lot larger, but the same situation. Should the Federation help their sworn enemies in the Romulans and do what they can to ease the suffering of those people, or should they turn their back and let them perish? I guess that's the moral and ethical question here. What do you guys think?
Well, they did the same thing that they presumably did with the Klingons, and they helped. And I think that
they helped.
And if you're the Federation, in my opinion, I think the right answer is you always try and save life. There's no more important, tenet than exploring strange new worlds and discovering new life. Most of the best episodes, like Measure of a Man that we talked about last Thursday, are about life. So I think Picard absolutely made the right decision, and I think Starfleet made the right decision in helping the Romulans.
And Picard even says that in the interview when the woman says, well, these were Romulans, and Picard says, these were lives. He doesn't distinguish between Romulan lives and Federation lives. These were lives, and they needed our help, and we helped them.
One of the things I was holding back after I read the book, or was reading the book, and we jumped in talking about trying to talk about what was going on. And I didn't really want to bring up when we were talking about the series and Eric hadn't read the book yet about how much a lot of people in the Federation dislike the Romulans. There was a lot of bias against the Romulans. And the beginning of the book and throughout the book, there are points of people, Bruce Maddox, people on Mars, are having to give up their projects to go work on helping the Romulans. Well, that's not their first priority. They didn't want to help the Romulans. They're more worrying about dealing with the Federation.
I think that's a valid point, too.
The Federation got a, even though it was a bit, bumpy at times, there was still a friendship or connection with the Federation and the Klingons, whereas that didn't exist with the Romulans. And
I agree, a lot of people were like,
well, why should we help the Romulans? They've always been our sworn enemy.
And, you know, maybe we'd see the seeds of that in Nemesis with Denatra and how she helps defeat Shinzon, you know?
Yeah, she's a very honorable Romulan in that episode. And I'm sure that we get pushback from the Klingons because the Romulans are without honor. And so I'm sure the Klingons had some pushback about the Romulans as well.
That's a good point, Jim. They don't bring that up at all in this book, and I would bet that the Klingons were super pissed off about this.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that they were.
And I wonder how many other groups that we don't know details about, but other groups that had dealt with the Romulans that had problems with them, or having to go
right
up against Tal Shiar and the issues that Tal Shiar had created.
Well, another group that probably wasn't all too excited about it either were the Vulcans, because Spock was trying to get reunification, and the Vulcans were dead against that. So you got pressure from the Vulcans, you got pressure from the Klingons. That's a lot of pressure to deal with. So,
yep.
You know what, guys? I am so glad that I actually could participate in this conversation finally.
Jim Judy's so busy, doesn't get a chance to pull out a novel. And now you're kind of seeing why we like pulling out novels, because we're getting great stories adding to what we've already gotten from Star Trek.
Yeah, I couldn't give you much input for the novel, and that's cool that I can sit back and let you guys take over. But I did get to take place in the conversation at the end, so I enjoyed it. It was well worth it. You guys, did you enjoy our first book nook? Do you think this is something we might not want to do it, you know, all the time, but is this something you guys might want to do again with another book? Maybe I can get it on a Kindle or something, and maybe I can join in at some point.
Oh, definitely. There's some great Star Trek books out, and I'm hoping there's going to be some more novels coming out based on Picard or Discovery.
Yeah,
I mean, we still have Comic Corner, which, you know, we can still do Comic Corner. We just don't have any new comics yet.
And we talked about, I think, just one Discovery book, right? And there's a bunch of them out there. There's four,
yeah,
I think, now. So.
Yeah. We've talked about...
Yeah, so...
Oh, no. We didn't talk. No, it was... I'm trying to think of...
This is the first one.
You guys talked about one briefly.
Yeah, we talked about the one, the Spock
Michael Burnham issue.
Yeah.
Well, if you guys want to do another book nook, if you enjoyed this one and you want to do another one, just let me know what book you guys want to talk about. I'll get it scheduled, and then maybe I can track it down and give it a read and join you. If not, I can always jump at the end like I did today. And I really enjoyed it. I had a good time. I think you guys did a great job covering the book and letting our listeners know about it and making them want to go out and read it. So I want to say thank you, Eric, very much for taking some time out of your schedule to hang out with us tonight and talk on the Book Nook about Star Trek Picard, The Last Best Hope by Una McCormick. Thank you very much, Eric, for hanging out with us.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Charles. That was a blast. And thanks,
oh, thank you. That was a great discussion.
Uh-huh. Yeah, thank you to you, Charles. And also, Charles, thank you for hanging out with me and Leslie on Stunt Treks on Sunday nights and Book Nook on Monday night and our brand new one, Sounds of Sci-Fi and Horror, on Tuesday night and Trek Talking on Thursday night. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's been fun.
I'm kind of stuck at home. Might as well get the best out of it.
And we do indeed. And, of course, I want to thank each and every one of you guys out there listening. Thank you very much for being fans. We appreciate you guys. Tune in tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, same bat time, same bat channel. We have a really good show planned for you guys. We've got some great movie and TV themes to play and discuss. So sit back and enjoy that. You might hear some guilty pleasures, maybe something you forgot about. So check that out tomorrow. And Thursday night, we have Trek Talking and Beyond. Is there a Star Trek Discovery movie in the works? Dun, dun, dun. You'll have to tune in to find out. I already told you guys that LeVar Burton's going to be back, but could there be others? Dun, 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 dun. You'll have to tune in Thursday night to find out.
Yeah.
And make sure you check out our Facebook page. Go ahead, Charles.
All right, fans. You're so used to Jim doing a lot of research and throwing stuff together. Well, you're going to see, if you got a chance to see Tuesday's notes, coming up tomorrow, it's not all Jim's notes. I went through and looked through, what are my favorite sci-fi fantasy movies and TV shows? And I got through a list of great stuff from 70s and 80s that I think a lot from our era are going to love.
Yeah, and the format of our new show, guys, is there is no format. That's what makes it so fun. We just talk about what Wonder Woman, Battlestar Galactica, the Bionic Man, whatever we happen, we don't know. And so that's what makes it so fun. Is we never know what we're going to talk about. So you want to tune in for that one because it's not Star Trek. It's everything. 70s, 80s, 90s.
I picked up quite a few stuff that just has memories in my past. And I think it's going to bring back a lot of other people's memories, too.
Yeah, we have a great show. So check that out tomorrow at 7 o'clock. And Leslie Hoffman joins us as well, and she'll tell you some stories. If we happen to play a clip from a show that she was on, she'll tell you about working on that show with those actors or whatever it happened to be. So you want to tune in for that. That'll be Tuesday, tomorrow at 7 o'clock. So that wraps up our Book Nook. Thank you very much, guys, for joining us. We really appreciate it. You guys are the best. Star Trek fans are the best fans. You better believe it. Please be good to each other and try to be safe. We'll see you again tomorrow for Sounds of Sci-Fi and Thursday night for Trek Talking and Beyond. Thanks for hanging out with us. This is our first episode of Book Nook, and I think we're going to be bringing you more. Stay tuned at our Facebook page to find out where and when you can tune in. Thanks a lot, guys. Have a good one. Good night, everybody.
Now,
live long and prosper.
Let's see what's out there.